Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 245, but who's counting? It's Monday, February 5th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, let's start with an Ohio story. This from NBC News. Ohio reverses local flavored tobacco bans, infuriating doctors. On New Year's Day, the city of Columbus, Ohio, did what federal government has not been able to do, ban the sale of menthol cigarettes. 3 weeks later, the state legislature voted to reinstate menthol and other flavored tobacco products and strip all of its cities of their ability to regulate what type of tobacco is sold or enforce who is old enough to buy it. Ohio is just the latest state to limit what local communities can do about tobacco use. At least 39 other states have passed similar laws, according to the American Lung Association. The move has frustrated public health officials in Ohio, who say residents are already at greater risk of dying early from smoking-related diseases. Ohio has one of the highest smoking rates among adults in the country, 17.1% compared to the national rate of 11.5%, according to the American Cancer Society. I am very concerned when politicians start deciding what they think is best for the health of the population, said Dr. Myshika Roberts, Health Commissioner for Columbus Public Health. We know that tobacco products are harmful. Flavored tobacco products in particular have been the focus of public health organizations and anti-smoking groups for more than a decade. Experts blame the meteoric rise in teen vaping on candy and fruit-flavored e-cigarettes. The federal government banned flavored e-cigarettes in 2020, but left menthol products on the market. A federal ban on menthol, which was expected last year, has been delayed until at least March, and a White House spokesman said last Monday that the administration has no update on the matter. The inaction prompted the city of Columbus and some of its suburbs to pass its own flavor bans, including menthol. Lawmakers in Cleveland had also begun the process of prohibiting flavored tobacco products. That all went away January 24th when the Ohio Senate voted to override its governor's veto of this provision. It is the intent of the General Assembly to preempt political subdivisions from the regulation of tobacco products and alternative nicotine products. In other words, cities, counties, and townships in Ohio cannot take it upon themselves to enact or enforce any tobacco control laws. The action negated Columbus's ban on flavored tobacco products and erased any chance that Cleveland would put forth such a law. This is beyond frustrating, said Micah Berman, a public health and law expert with the Center for Tobacco Research at the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center. This is about the most obvious thing that we can do to prevent people from getting cancer. The issue is a priority for health officials in Cleveland, where 35% of adults smoke. Yikes, that's like double the Ohio rate, which is higher than the national rate. Smoking is the number one preventable cause of death and disease and disability in the city of Cleveland, said Dr. David Margolis, Cleveland's public health director. Well, yeah, it's actually true for all, it's the single largest preventable cause of death in Ohio in the U.S., but yikes, Cleveland's even way, way higher. Black communities are impacted the most and use menthol products at far higher rates. Nearly 85% of black smokers use menthols, compared to 30% of white smokers, according to the FDA. And black men have the highest lung cancer death rate in the U.S. We had hoped to take our destiny into our own hands by passing a local law that would help save lives, but now the state has prohibited us from doing so, Margolis said. We are really counting on the White House to step in. Okay, Biden administration, get your act together and ban menthol tobacco products. Okay, well, next up, a flashback to 1950, this from Associated Press. The U.S. hasn't seen syphilis numbers this high since 1950. Other STD rates are down or flat. The U.S. syphilis epidemic isn't abating, with the rate of infectious cases rising 9% in 2022, according to a new federal government report on sexually transmitted diseases in adults. But there's some unexpected good news. The rate of new gonorrhea cases fell for the first time in a decade. It's not clear why infectious cases of syphilis rose 9% while gonorrhea dropped 9%, officials at the CDC said, adding that it's too soon to know whether the new downward trend is emerging for the latter, that is, gonorrhea. They are most focused on syphilis, which is less common than gonorrhea or chlamydia, but considered much more dangerous. And while it continues to have a disproportionate impact on gay and bisexual men, it is expanding to heterosexual men and women and increasingly affecting newborns too, CDC officials said. Total cases surpassed 207,000 in 2022, a 17% increase and the highest count in the United States since 1950. The count includes not only the most infectious stages of the disease, but also latent cases and cases in which pregnant women pass syphilis onto their babies. Syphilis is a bacterial disease that can surface as painless genital sores, but can ultimately lead to paralysis, hearing loss, dementia, and even death if left untreated. New syphilis infections plummeted in the U.S. starting in the 1940s, when antibiotics became widely available, and fell to their lowest in 1998. About 59,000 of the 2022 cases involved the most infectious forms of syphilis. Of those, about a quarter were women, and nearly a quarter were heterosexual men. So, that's generally about half among heterosexuals. I think it's unknowingly being spread in the cisgender heterosexual population because we really weren't testing for it. We really aren't looking for it in that population, said Dr. Philip Chan, who teaches at Brown University and is chief medical officer of Open Door Health, a health center for gay, lesbian, and transgender patients in Providence, Rhode Island. The report also shows rates of the most infectious types of syphilis rose not just across the country, but also across different racial and ethnic groups, with American Indian and Alaskan Native people having the highest rate. South Dakota outpaced any other state for the highest rate of infectious syphilis at 84 cases per 100,000 people, more than twice as high as the state with the second highest rate, which is New Mexico. South Dakota's increase was driven by an outbreak in the Native American community, said Dr. Megan O'Connell, chief public health officer at the Great Plains Tribal Leaders Health Board, based in Rapid City, South Dakota. Nearly all the cases were in heterosexual people, and O'Connell said that STD testing and treatment was already limited in isolated tribal communities and only got worse during the pandemic. Okay, next up, in another flashback of sorts, I have a very interesting article that's looking back on the effects of the Voting Rights Act on black infant mortality. This from the American Journal of Public Health. 1965 U.S. Voting Rights Act impact on black and black versus white infant death rates in Jim Crow states. Black infant deaths in Voting Rights Act exposed counties decreased by an average of 18% beyond the decrease experienced by unexposed counties between the pre-Voting Rights Act period, that is 1959 to 1965, and the post-Voting Rights Act period, 1966 to 1970. The equivalent differential changes were not significant among the white population. So this is a good example of where democracy is a public health issue, and that having a functioning democracy by the people and for the people and includes all the people results in more equity, including health equity. In this case, one of the most sensitive indicators of community health, infant deaths. Okay, next up from Reuters. Growing cancer burden masks inequity among rich and poor nations, says World Health Organization. There are an estimated 20 million cancer cases and 9.7 million cancer deaths in 2022, the World Health Organization's Cancer Research Agency said. A growing burden that masks what it calls, quote, striking inequity among rich and poor countries. For example, in the most developed countries, 1 in 12 women get breast cancer in their lifetimes, but only 1 in 71 women die from breast cancer. In countries that are lower on the Human Development Index, 1 in 27 women get breast cancer, in part because populations tend to be much younger, but also as a result of a lower exposure to risk factors like being overweight. But one in 48 women die from it. Okay, well, that's a lot of number and numbers. And to put it in summary, that means women in these lower income countries are half as likely to actually get breast cancer during their lifetime. But overall, they are actually 68% more likely to die from breast cancer than women in the most developed countries. Women in these countries are less likely to be diagnosed, yet they are at much higher risk of dying of the disease due to late diagnosis and inadequate access to quality treatment. Different types of cancer were now increasingly affecting populations as lifestyles change. For example, colorectal cancer is now the third most common cancer and second in terms of deaths. Colorectal cancer is linked to lifestyle factors like obesity, as well as smoking and alcohol use. And I would add, along the diet front, it's not simply just obesity, but having a low-quality diet like a highly processed, low-fiber diet is also a risk factor for colorectal cancer. However, lung cancer has also reemerged as one of the most common, as the most common cancer and the leading cause of death, with 2.5 million new cases and 1.8 million deaths annually. This was likely linked to persistent tobacco use in Asia. There would likely be a 77% increase in cases by 2050 to 35 million as the population grows and ages, but the impact will be uneven. In poor countries, cases will rise by 142%, the agency said, and mortality rates will double. Once again, a story of inequity between the rich and the poor. And next up, in that same vein, this from Newsweek, wasting in a world of plenty. There is a deep injustice in our food system. For a nation to thrive, every child, family, and community must have access to nutritious food that they can afford. This basic right is just a dream for 800 million people around the world who go to bed hungry every night. Yet ironically, while 10% of the world goes hungry, in our world of plenty, we waste shocking amounts of food. According to a 2023 report by the US EPA, over one-third of the food produced in the U.S. doesn't get eaten. Most of it ends up in landfills, creating tons of methane gas that worsens climate change. This is not a new problem. Back in 2015, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, along with the EPA, set a target to cut food waste by 50% by 2030. The U.S. has not made much headway towards achieving this goal, and so the fruits of prosperity die on the vine. While our food wastes in landfills, lives are wasting away. Globally, 45 million children are experiencing the worst type of malnutrition, known as wasting, which for some means literally starving to death. More than 1 million children die of wasting each year. At the same time, 2 out of 3 women of reproductive age lack the key vitamins and minerals they need to survive and thrive. And 3 billion people out of 8 billion on the planet cannot afford a nutritious diet. The numbers are staggering, especially because good nutrition is the building block of development and the anchor of human health. In all its forms, most of the world's potential is wasting away from malnutrition. But malnutrition is a preventable tragedy. We have proven scalable solutions to prevent it, and for those most at risk, we have therapeutic nutrition products that can save children from dying. We also know the price of investing in a thriving population. Achieving the World Health Assembly targets for good nutrition would cost just $10.8 billion per year, nearly one-fourth of the amount Americans spent on soda last year, and only a fraction of what it would take to live in a world where children no longer die of wasting. Currently, significant underinvestment undermines progress on nearly all of the United Nations' Sustainable Development Goals. Over these past 2 years, the seeds of change have been planted. In 2022, we saw the largest commitment ever to child wasting treatment, with more than $500 million committed by public and private donors to dramatically increase malnutrition treatment coverage. And again, to put that in context, that's $500 million out of the $10.8 billion needed, so just less than 5%. Nonetheless, this historic investment resulted in 7.3 million children under 5 being reached with life-saving treatment globally for severe wasting, which was a 35% increase from 2021, the highest annual increase and the highest number of children treated for severe wasting since large-scale treatment began. We are also seeing exciting new innovations in how to finance and scale delivery of nutrition services. The Child Nutrition Fund, a new effort to unlock financing for the scale-up of wasting prevention and treatment, including critical domestic resources, is quickly growing, focused on essential government-led actions for the early prevention, detection, and treatment of child wasting. In parallel, after nearly 10 years of work, much of it catalyzed by philanthropy, the World Health Organization launched new guidelines for the prevention and treatment of acute malnutrition. Among other potentially life-saving recommendations, the revised guidelines empower community health workers to diagnose and treat children for acute malnutrition in their homes. This is also a moment to pursue equity for all women, no matter where they live. Prenatal vitamins, a product which most pregnant women in America can easily access, have historically been unavailable to women in the rest of the world, but are now ready to be scaled to everyone. Referred to as multiple micronutrient supplements, or MMS, simple solutions like this can protect the lives of millions of women and their babies during pregnancy and after birth. And for the first time, nutrition's critical role was featured prominently in the other great challenge of our time, climate change. At the International Climate Conference, COP28, hundreds of countries and non-state actors made new commitments to support sustainable, nutritious food systems. And at the World Economic Forum recently in Davos, the food waste crisis was discussed at many tables. We are on the path to saving and improving the lives of millions around the world. The evidence, vision, and infrastructure for transformational change is in place, and the socioeconomic benefits of every dollar spent on nutrition are in double digits. That means these kind of interventions bring 10 or more dollars for every dollar invested. Good investment. Many countries and organizations are lining up alongside other partners to take action. Though the momentum is here, we need more determined action from country governments, philanthropies, and multilateral agencies faster to make this dream a reality. Okay, well, next up, I want to switch gears a bit and do a case study of sorts about public health, which has to deal with a lot of issues that may be low probability, but if they happen, could be disastrous, such as pandemics. And of course, if it never happens, you probably won't hear about it. But if it does happen, there's blowback to be had by all, including public health. This from Kaiser Family Foundation Health News. Possibility of wildlife to human crossover heightens concern about chronic wasting disease. Each fall, millions of hunters across North America make their way into forests and grasslands to kill deer. Over the winter, people chow down on the venison steaks, sausage, and burgers made from the animals. These hunters, however, are not just on the front lines of an American tradition. Infectious disease research say they're also on the front lines of what could be a serious threat to public health: chronic wasting disease. The neurological disease, which is contagious, rapidly spreading, and always fatal, is caused by misfolded proteins called prions. It currently is known to infect only members of the cervid family, that is elk, deer, reindeer, caribou, and moose. Animal disease scientists are alarmed about the rapid spread of chronic wasting disease in deer. Recent research shows that the barrier to spillover into humans is less formidable than previously believed, and that the prions causing the disease may be evolving to become more able to infect humans. A response to the threat is ramping up. In 2023, a coalition of researchers began working on a major initiative, bringing together 68 different global experts on various aspects of chronic wasting disease to really look at what are the challenges ahead should we see a spillover into humans and food production, said Micah Osterholm, an expert in infectious disease at the University of Minnesota and a leading authority on chronic wasting disease. The bottom line message is we are quite unprepared, Osterholm said. If we saw a spillover right now, we would be in a free fall. There is no contingency plan for what to do or how to follow up. The team of experts is planning for a potential outbreak, focusing on public health surveillance, lab capacity, prion disease diagnostics, surveillance of livestock and wildlife, risk communication, and education and outreach. Despite the concern, tens of thousands of infected animals have been eaten by people in recent years, yet there have been no known cases of the disease in humans. Many hunters have wrestled with how seriously to take the threat of chronic wasting disease. The predominant opinion I encounter is that no human being has gotten this disease, said Steve Rinella, a writer and founder of Meat Eater, a media and lifestyle company focused on hunting and cooking wild game. Prions behave very differently than viruses and bacteria and are virtually impossible to eradicate. Matthew Dunphy, director of the Chronic Wasting Disease Alliance, said experts call it a, quote, disease from outer space. Symptoms are gruesome. The brain deteriorates into a spongy consistency. Sometimes nicknamed zombie deer disease, the condition makes infected animals stumble, drool, and stare blankly before they die. There is no treatment or vaccine, and is extremely difficult to eradicate, whether with disinfectants or with high heat. It even survives autoclaving or medical sterilization. Research estimates that between 7,000 and 15,000 infected animals are unknowingly consumed by hunters' families annually, a number that increases every year as the disease spreads across the continent. While testing of wild game for chronic wasting disease is available, it's cumbersome and the tests are not widely used in many places. A major problem with determining whether chronic wasting disease has affected humans is that it has a long latency. People who consume prions may not contract the resulting disease until many years later. So if someone fell sick, there might not be an apparent connection to having eaten deer. Prions are extremely persistent in the environment. They can remain in the ground for many years and even be taken up by plants. So this is a potential worst case scenario because it's so fatal and it's so hard to actually prevent that if we get a jump to human beings and then you get human to human transmission, or even if just deer or soil to plant transmission allows human infections, it could be a long unfolding. Unfortunately, it could be a fairly quick reckoning of a worldwide pandemic. And I will cite another bonus article later in the show that you can read online that gets even to more details. And of course, I added to that article, there's more to read in that one as well. Okay, well, next up, let's switch perspectives again. This from military.com. Access to abortion drug is a national security issue, former top military officials claim in legal filing. Former secretaries of the Army, Navy, and Air Force, as well as former high-ranking military service members, say that restricting access to mifepristone, the medication used in more than half of all medical abortions in the U.S., would hurt recruitment, military readiness, and cause undue harm to national security. They added that restrictions would also affect operational readiness if it caused women to leave the service to care for unplanned or unwanted children, and would hamper the Defense Department's ability to provide all aspects of health care to women. Women represent a higher percentage of the recruitable population than their male counterparts, they added, citing a report by the RAND Corporation, a Washington, D.C.-based think tank. Thus, given the current challenges of military recruitment, the nation can't afford for the services to not offer healthcare access that supports their training, service, career progression, and personal choices, the brief adds. A Government Accountability Office report published in 2020 found that women separate from the armed forces at a rate 28% higher than men. The GAO found that women largely leave the service over six concerns: family planning, dependent care, work schedules, organizational culture, deployments, and sexual assault. With women making up half the potential recruiting pool, the DoD needs to do more to address the continuing gaps between gender in the U.S. military, the GAO said. Those filing the amicus brief to the Supreme Court said that the availability of reproductive health care, including abortion care, is critical to attracting women to the services and retaining them. Put simply, lack of access to reproductive health care, including abortion care, and the real prospect of being forced to take unwanted or unsafe pregnancies to term only makes the military less attractive to today's recruitment age females, they wrote. Yes, my friends, abortion care is a national security issue in so many ways. Okay, next up from Axios, U.S. permanently eases some opioid treatment restrictions. Pandemic-era policies that made it easier for patients to receive opioid addiction treatment will continue permanently, the Biden administration announced last week. Why it matters? The changes mark the first time in 20 years the federal government has updated rules governing clinics that provide medication-assisted treatment for opioid use disorder. Years into the nation's opioid crisis, only about 1 in 5 people with opioid addiction received medication to treat it in 2021. The finalized policy will allow patients to take home doses of the opioid addiction treatment methadone. Patients will also be able to start on methadone or buprenorphine, another opioid addiction treatment medication, via telehealth. Before the pandemic, patients taking methadone had to go in person to an opioid treatment clinic each day to receive treatment. Those rules were relaxed during the pandemic to help reduce infection risk. Federal Health Officials cited reports that those flexibilities increased treatment and patient satisfaction with their care, without notable increases in diversion of methadone, which itself is an opioid. The policies could especially help people in rural areas where providers are in short supply. Of note, the rule ends a requirement that patients have a year-long history of opioid misuse before getting admitted to an opioid treatment clinic. It allows nurse practitioners and physician assistants also to order opioid use disorder medication where state laws permit it. And next up, also on the drug front, this from Medical Express, U.S. prescription drug prices are 2.8 times those in other wealthy nations. Prescription drug prices in the U.S. are significantly higher than in other nations, with prices in the U.S. averaging 2.8 times those seen in 33 other nations, according to a new RAND report. The gap between prices in the U.S. and other countries is even larger for brand name drugs, with U.S. prices averaging 4.2 times those in comparison countries. The RAND study found that prices for unbranded generic drugs, which account for 90% of prescription volume in the U.S., are about 67% of the average cost in the comparison nations. These findings provide further evidence that manufacturers' gross prices for prescription drugs are higher in the U.S. than in comparison countries, said Andrew McCaughey, lead author of the study and senior health economist at RAND, a nonprofit research organization. We find that the gap is widening for name brand drugs, while U.S. prices for generic drugs are now proportionally lower than our earlier analysis found. Recent estimates are that prescription drug spending in the U.S. accounts for more than 10% of all health care spending. And that may not seem like a lot to some, but that was in low single digits just 10 or 20 years ago, like 3 or 4%. Now it's 10% of all health care spending in the U.S., driven almost exclusively by overpriced, high-priced brand name drugs. And next up from Axios, health insurance premiums are eating into workers' wages. Families with workplace health insurance may have missed out on $125,000 in earnings over the past three decades as a result of rising premiums eating into their pay, according to a JAMA Network Open study. Why it matters? While employers, rather than workers, typically bear the brunt of rising health insurance costs, the study is further evidence that rising premiums are costing workers through wages that they would have otherwise received. And it's costing low-income employees and people of color the most. Premium growth has long outpaced wage growth, meaning that health insurance has become a larger and larger part of workers' total compensation as employers pay out more in health benefits. Premiums usually don't vary on income based on income level, making them a larger percentage of total compensation for low-income workers, who are disproportionately people of color, than those with higher incomes. Employer insurance has gotten more and more expensive as healthcare itself has gotten more and more expensive. The average workplace health plan last year cost $24,000 for family coverage, with employers covering about three-quarters of the cost. Although workers most directly feel the impact of their healthcare spending through out-of-pocket costs, economists have long argued that soaring premiums have suppressed wage growth. In 1988, healthcare premiums on average accounted for 7.9% of a worker's total compensation, which includes wages and premiums. By 2019, that had increased to an average of 17.7%, according to a study led by researchers at the School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University. In each of the 32 years in the study period, healthcare premiums were a larger percentage of compensation for Black and Hispanic families than for white families with employer insurance. Those disparities have also increased over time, the authors found. The bottom line? Our results depict the hidden costs of increasing health insurance premiums for the U.S. worker, less opportunity for wage growth, and a heavier burden of health insurance premiums on lower-paid workers and on Black and Hispanic workers. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And my guarantee to you is if you listen to this show for a year, you will know more about public health than 99% of the population. And if that should not be the case, you get triple your money back. And for those of you still loving the free market solutions to healthcare, this from The Guardian, majority of debtors to U.S. hospitals now people with health insurance. People with health insurance may now represent the majority of debtors American hospitals struggle to collect from, according to medical billing analysts. This marks a sea change from just a few years ago, when people with health insurance represented only about 1 in 10 hospital bills considered bad debt, the analyst said. We always used to consider bad debt, especially bad debt write-offs from a hospital perspective, those patients who have the ability to pay but don't, said Colleen Hall, Senior Vice President for Kodiak Solutions, a billing, accounting, and consulting firm that works closely with hospitals and performs the analysis. Although bad debt can be a controversial metric in its own right, those who work in the hospital billing industry say it shows how complex health insurance products with large out-of-pocket costs have proliferated. What we noticed was a breaking point right around 2018 to 2019, said Matt Szaflarski, Director of Revenue Cycle Intelligence at Kodiak Solutions. The trend has since stabilized, but remains at more than half of all bad debt. In 2018, just 11% of hospitals' bad debt came from insured self-pay accounts or from patients whose insurance required out-of-pocket payments, according to Kodiak. By 2022, the proportion who did or could not pay their bills soared to 57% of all hospitals' bad debt. The cost of healthcare in the U.S. is a perennial political concern. It eats up more than 18% of gross domestic product, far more and often for worse health outcomes than in other peer democracies. As much as 31% of the cost of U.S. healthcare is probably driven by the administration of complex bills that now beset the public. Now, medical debt and its impact on Americans' lives is an issue of increasing political perseveration. A recent investigation by Kaiser Family Foundation Health News and NPR found more than 100 million Americans have medical debt of some kind, debt which often forces families to make heart-wrenching sacrifices. In part, those sacrifices are driven by hospitals' extraordinary collection practices. Hospitals refer patients to aggressive debt collectors, use state courts to garnish wages, place liens on people's homes, and report debt to credit agencies, which can drastically worsen future job and housing prospects. Although there are some attempts to rein in those practices, billing analysts like Szaflarski says they do not address the core issue, health plans designed by insurers which force hospitals to become debt collectors. Deductibles have come under particular scrutiny as the share of workers subject to high deductibles has risen in the last decade. There is not a single definition for a high deductible health plan, but typically such plans require a payment of $1,000 or more before insurance kicks in for a single person, though costs can soar far above that. Because deductibles reset every year, they can be especially punishing for chronically ill patients, and they can be far more expensive than $1,000 a year. Obamacare plans, that is insurance plans people buy as individuals on state exchanges, are notorious for such high deductibles. Federal regulations allow insurers on state exchanges to charge an individual as much as $9,450 out of pocket in 2024, not including monthly payments called premiums. That limit is predicted to grow to $14,100 by 2030. And because healthcare costs are rising faster than wages, those expenses are predicted to eat up an ever larger share of Americans' paychecks. Further, patient advocates criticize bad debt as a metric on its own right. Hospitals view bad debt as bills patients could pay but choose not to, but hospitals rarely screen patients for their ability to pay, and a raft of evidence shows patients who experience medical debt are often low income and would probably qualify for discounted or free care if they went through hospitals' lengthy application process. It's obvious to hospitals that if someone comes to them is uninsured, there's a need there. But if they're insured and can't afford their insurance, their processes and systems are not designed to detect that need. And thus, now a majority of people who have bad debt to hospitals are, in fact, people that are insured.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens the nations who assure health care for all. That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, much of the healthcare in this country is spent in the final months and years of life. And this next report from Medical Express gets at that process. A study of how Americans die may improve their end of life. A Rutgers Health analysis of millions of Medicare records has laid the groundwork for improving end-of-life care by demonstrating that nearly all older Americans follow one of nine trajectories in their last 3 years of life. Identifying which paths people actually take is a necessary precursor to identifying which factors send people down different paths and designing interventions that send more people down whatever path is right for them, said Olga Jaron, a professor of nursing research at Rutgers and corresponding author of the study published in BMC Geriatrics. The team pulled the final 3 years of clinical records from a randomly selected 10% of all 2 million Medicare beneficiaries who died in 2018. Analysis of how much personal care each patient received and where they received care revealed three major care clusters: home, skilled home care, and institutional care. Each cluster contains three distinct trajectories. Roughly 59% of patients fell into the home cluster, meaning they spent most of their last 3 years at home while friends and family helped them with any tasks they couldn't do for themselves. Such patients typically received little professional care, either in their own homes or in nursing homes, until the last year of life. Another 27% of patients fell into the skilled home care cluster, meaning nurses and other skilled professionals helped family and friends care for them inside their own homes for most of their final 3 years. The final 14% of patients fell into the institutional care cluster and spent most of their final 3 years either in hospitals or, more commonly, nursing homes, receiving nearly all necessary care from paid professionals. The researchers use a group-based trajectory modeling approach, evaluating associations between care trajectories and both sociodemographic and health-related metrics. Patients in both the skilled home care and institutional care clusters were more likely than patients in the home cluster to be female, Black, enrolled in Medicaid, or suffering from dementia. The study is the first of several the researchers plan to base on their analysis of the Medicare data. Now that they have identified the trajectories that people actually follow in the last years of life, they will look at the key factors that direct people down each path and interventions that will help more people stick to the path they prefer. Okay, well, next up, as in the last year, the Surgeon General had declared a loneliness epidemic in America. This from Medical Express. Loneliness is plaguing Americans in 2024, says poll. Among U.S. adults, about 1 in 3 said they feel lonely at least once a week. Worse, 1 in 10 Americans say they feel lonely every day, results show. Younger people are more likely to experience loneliness, which is defined as lack of meaningful or close relationships or sense of belonging, according to the American Psychiatric Association's latest Healthy Minds monthly poll. About 30% of respondents age 18 to 34 said they feel lonely every day or several times a week. The poll, which was conducted online from January 10th to January 12th among 2,200 adults, also found that single adults are nearly twice as likely as married adults to feel lonely on a weekly basis, 39% of those single versus 22% of those married. About 50% of respondents ease their loneliness with distractions like TV, podcasts, or social media. Another 41% said they go for a walk to feel less lonely, while 38% said they reach out to family or friends. Overall, 13% said they use drugs or alcohol to ease their loneliness, with adults 18 to 34 more likely to use substances than those 45 to 64. That is 21% versus 8%. So that's a pretty high risk there when you're talking nearly triple the risk of using alcohol or drugs for those that report the regular loneliness. And loneliness has been linked to increased risk of heart disease, stroke, type 2 diabetes, depression, anxiety, addiction, dementia, and early death, according to the CDC. The CDC says people can combat loneliness by spending more time with family and friends, joining a group or club related to an interest or hobby, spending time with others in nature, expressing gratitude to others, volunteering with community organizations, and getting to know your neighbors. Well, we live in the most disconnected society ever on the planet, so may we learn to connect and reconnect with one another. And last up, something on our virtual lives, this from Medical Express. Why attention spans seem to be shrinking and what we can do about it. Most of us think we're good at multitasking, said Art Kramer, professor of psychology and director of the Center for Cognitive and Brain Health at Northeastern. We're pretty terrible at it overall. Computer scientists and psychologists have been studying attention spans for about 20 years, over which time the average time that a person can focus on one thing has dropped from around 2.5 minutes to around 45 seconds. Kramer says exact numbers can fluctuate, but research has certainly suggested that we can't pay attention as well as we used to. He cited a number of reasons. First is a constant bombardment of information that we receive. We used to watch the news when we came home in the evening, maybe also in the morning. Now you get that information in real time. In fact, it may pop up on your screen. Indeed, our screens are now everywhere, not just in our living room or office, but in our hands and in our cars. Kramer notes that his former PhD student David Strayer found the infotainment technology on new cars to be as distracting as texting and driving. Moreover, Kramer notes the ability to find information is just a click away, meaning that a distraction or anything that takes your mind and efforts away from what you're trying to accomplish can quickly usurp a previous task and refocus your attention. Scientists can see this happening by examining the brain with an MRI or other non-invasive brain imaging techniques, such as eye tracking or recording EEG information with electrodes placed on the head. There are a number of factors that can improve aspects of attention, processing speed, memory, reasoning, and problem solving, Kramer says. Some are simply by eliminating distractions like turning off the notifications on your phone or closing the multiple tabs open on your computer or putting phones away. Handheld phones being outlawed while driving is a good start, Kramer says, but he adds no panacea. Other methods to improve attention involve training. Mindfulness is one popular method. Lifestyle changes may prove to be effective. For instance, scientists have found a relationship between physical fitness and better attention. As people improve their cardiorespiratory fitness, a multitude of positive changes occur in brain function that improve many cognitive functions, including the ability to screen out distractions. He also suggested taking up a new instrument or learning a new language as a way for a person to continue enhancing their minds. Reducing stress and getting enough sleep also helps people successfully deal with distractions. And social interaction, and maybe even healthy eating, also seems to help people improve attention. Well, if you made it to the regular reporting on the show today, you must have a halfway decent attention span. Thank you for that. And that brings us to our last feature in the show, bonus articles. A carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. 23 bonus articles this week. First up, disinformation is the real threat to democracy and public health. Whether vaccine denial, climate denial, election denial, or war crime denial. So this is another one of those big social determinants, if you will, that can impact public health and your own individual health profoundly. So disinformation is a public health issue. Bonus article 2. For-profit journals are corrupting scientific advancements. A new model is needed. So in the last decade or so, science journals, which are for-profit, have really changed their model to extract as much money as possible and create huge paywalls that really slow down the ability for scientific information to be shared. And this article is a story about one of those editors who spun off and did a new nonprofit thing to do it much more cheaply and to make it much more accessible. Bonus article 3. Ohio and Pennsylvania mark the one-year anniversary of East Palestine train crash. So this is a good overview of what happened and where we're at right now with that disaster. Bonus Article 4 gets to some of that. Vinyl chloride industry keeps expanding despite East Palestine disaster. So even with something that caught so much attention, the inertia behind the petrochemical industry, in this case, the vinyl chloride industry, is still going gangbusters. And with all the lobbying they're doing, very powerful political and economic interest, and doesn't see any slowing that down anytime soon. Bonus Article 5. An OxyContin advertiser will pay $350 million in the first ever opioid marketing settlement. So this is a first. There's been a whole bunch of different opioid crisis settlements, but this is the first ever one that was with had to deal with marketing and advertising. So there's a progress there. Bonus Article 6. The Federal Trade Commission is attacking drug makers' patent thickets. I've talked about this before. This is where, in order to keep a drug or a product or a device expensive and under proprietary control, not to go to generics or have people duplicate it, they create these little patent thickets, which is a whole bunch of little patents around that make it impossible to replicate it. And the FTC is going after some of these. We've heard this with EpiPens and a lot of asthma inhalers particularly. Bonus Article 7. Medicare Advantage lobbying fends off major reform in an election year. So as an election year, you don't want to rock the boat too much, and that's been the case with Medicare Advantage, although this article covers a variety of different fronts. And one of the good news buried in this is that Aduhelm, which was that new Alzheimer's drug that came out a year or so ago, which I've reported extensively on how much of a disaster it is on all fronts. Well, Biogen, the company that produced it, is giving up on it as a lost cause. There's some good news and one more battle won. On to the next. Bonus Article 8. As investors pile into psychedelics, idealism gives way to pharma economics. So there's a lot of exciting possibilities with psychedelics. And a lot of people interested in it from the therapeutic view, the more idealistic view, are finding that once the money comes in, that economics tends to run roughshod over the scientific and humane purposes of using psychedelics as a therapeutic. Bonus Article 9. Juul spent big to court black leaders to promote its e-cigarettes, new documents show. So just another uncovering of behind-the-scenes corporate groups who are trying to influence, in this case, black leaders, but all kinds of influencers in order to promote its e-cigarettes. And this explains some of the stories I reported on before where some prominent black leaders, perhaps a touch surprisingly, were fronting for these big corporations just a little too much. Bonus Article 10. Racial bias in arrests for mental health symptoms. This is something that's been widely known, but this has been a very intriguing and well-designed study that really controlled for looking at a whole bunch of arrests and looking at it by race and ethnicity and measuring specifically on multiple fronts the different mental health conditions and finding that blacks are about three times more likely to be arrested for the same level of mental health symptoms. Bonus Article 11, why LA's battle against a deadly disease relies on unpaid volunteers. Welcome to underfunded public health. LA County, which is bigger than many states, population and budget-wise, actually, this is about hepatitis C, a chronic disease that unfortunately, like many public health issues, disproportionately affects disenfranchised populations, and there's underinvestment. So they're relying on volunteers to do a lot of the tracking down and informing people of what their options are and connecting them to services. Bonus Article 12. The politics have changed. The South warms to expanded health benefits. So I've been reporting on how Medicaid expansion has been increasingly adopted by these Republican holdout states. But it's even going a little bit beyond that, too, as Republicans have moved from the kind of the elite Wall Street class to courting more working class folks. They have found that these folks have problems with getting decent, affordable health care. So it is starting to change the politics behind that. A good read. Bonus Article 13, Silicon Valley County becomes first in U.S. to declare loneliness as a public health emergency. So I'm reporting this just as kind of a canary in the coal mine. Here we are, a first. It tells you a little bit and maybe a tipping point that loneliness is being adopted more and more as a public health issue. And the follow-up to the story I did in the main part of the show, 14, deer are beta testing a nightmare disease. Prion diseases are poorly understood, and this one is devastating. Chronic wasting disease, 100% fatal. Another good add-on, those two articles. Read them both, and it'll be scary, and you'll be well-informed scary. Bonus Article 15, nearly 6 million American women, that's 1 in 20, became pregnant with rape, sexual coercion, or both during their lifetime. Frightening. Bonus Article 16, heat and wildfire smoke are even more harmful when combined. So I've been talking a fair amount recently in other episodes about the synergy between different risk factors. And they actually looked at more than just the heat, the outdoor temperature, and wildfire smoke. And they found that in combination, these were synergistic, meaning not more than just additive. It wasn't just twice as bad or the two separate things added together, but was a geometric increase, an exponential increase. So one of the reasons why it's really important to cut down every risk, because every risk, if it's piled on a bunch of other risk, has a disproportionate help when you go in that direction. Bonus Article 17. Why did NIH abruptly halt research on the harms of cell phone radiation? So this one is a very good, I can't really summarize it that quickly, but it's a good read to get at something. Probably my guess, probably the best summary would be, is that we're going to use cell phones whether we like it or not, and we don't want to get in the way of that venture. Bonus Article 18, this is the biology fun fact of the week. Your appendix is not, in fact, useless. I've been saying for decades that the appendix is actually, okay, what the appendix is it's a little kind of dead end tube, you know, in your digestive tract. And one of the things that I've been saying, which apparently it does, in fact, happen, is that it stores a little bit of your feces, which is a bunch of bacteria. So when you get diarrhea or use an antibiotic and you're kind of clean out your gut, it can repopulate with good, healthy bacteria. So you're not, you know, completely rebooting. And also the appendix does have a lot, appendix has a lot of immune tissue in it, so it's important in immune response. In fact, the gut is actually a huge center for immune activity. Not surprisingly, when we're a tube full of feces, we want to have a good immune barrier there. Bonus Article 19. Children who have dogs, especially girls, get an exercise boost, study finds. So this was a study where they looked at families, kind of a natural experiment, where some got dogs, and then some of the dog dies and they lost a dog. So, you know, there were dog households versus dog-free households. And they saw that, especially girls for some reason, they got about a 52-minute boost a day in exercise by having a dog. So part of this is a little bit of an artifact, is that we become more and more sedentary in our kind of virtual living. And when you have a dog, you have to take that out and walk the thing. And I don't know, maybe the girls are doing the walking more than the boys. I'm not sure, but it seemed to have a pretty profound effect getting additional exercise. Bonus Article 20, something that's still an issue. Updated COVID vaccine, 54% effective at preventing symptomatic infection. So this is important, that the effectiveness here is not talking about a serious disease where you're hospitalized or die, but just preventing symptomatic infection, which of course, if you're avoiding that, you're avoiding more serious disease as well. But, and this is only months, because it hasn't been that long since it came out last fall, but 54% effective in preventing a symptomatic infection. And it seemed that effectiveness, while it does wane after a while, seemed to be more persistent than some of the earlier vaccines. So, hey, if you can cut your risk of getting a symptomatic infection by over half, it seems like a good idea to me. Okay, some big stories to end off here. The last three. Bonus article 21. Extraction of raw materials to rise by 60% by 2060, says UN report. So this is under the category of we are literally consuming our planet. So this would be faster than any rise in population. We continue to extract more and more raw materials, which of course is a crisis in and of itself. Good. Bonus article 22 is a good juxtapositioning of history and science. The Roman Empire's worst plagues were linked to climate change. An interesting read and sort of a cautionary tale because this might be related to food security. And with climate change threatening that, if you don't have a lot of reserve and can't handle the stress of not having good food security, it can lead to a lot of social dislocation and political problems. And in this case, probably due to poor nutrition and poor economic conditions, it had some of the worst plagues during that time. Lastly, but not least, bonus article 23, cleaning water naturally, the ancient Maya way. Another great read. They would make these huge pools that would be naturally cleaned by, you know, reeds and an aquatic biosystem, clean enough that you can swim in them, not the dirty pools that some of us have been familiar with growing up, but it's a wondrous way to kind of like make our own bio-friendly water cleaning. You can view and read each of these stories and previous and from previous episodes by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.